Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Robert Smith. So I don't know if you've heard, but Planet Money is a big deal in the oil business right now.
Oh, yes. Last week, we bought 100 barrels of crude oil, which works out to a little more than 4,000 gallons of Kansas Sweet.
Although the guy we bought it from asked for the price for Oklahoma Sweet.
Yes.
Go back two episodes if you want to hear the most awkward negotiation in the history of oil.
Anyway, our oil is stranded in a tank in South Central Kansas because it rained and the people coming to pick up our oil could not make it on the muddy roads.
But finally, a shiny tanker truck pulls into this muddy road through a cornfield, and this guy gets out.
Scott Zimmerman.
What do you do?
Haul crude oil.
How are you not covered in oil? You look clean. I don't see any oil on you. You've been loading oil all day.
Well, you learn. When you first start out, when you go home, you wear more oil home than you haul. And then over the years, you learn how to stay clean.
Part of it is rag management. He's always daubing up little bits of oil.
Oh, yeah. A lot of rags.
Scott is the very first step in a long process of turning our crude oil, 100 barrels of it fresh out of the ground, into gasoline for your car.
Now we've opened up the tank and we're going to open up our load lines.
Scott putters around the truck, pulls out what looks like a giant vacuum cleaner tube.
Okay.
And hooks it up to the tank.
Let's open up our valve on our tank and we're going to kick our pump in. And that's the procedure right there.
Scott pulls out. The oil refinery is about 2 hours north of here. And so Scott could theoretically just drive right there and start processing our oil, but he doesn't do that. He heads in a different direction.
Scott is driving to a pipeline because the key to the oil business is to drive as little as possible and pipe everything you can. It's slower, but it is much cheaper.
And it's safer. There are pipeline leaks, sure, but oil trucks and rail cars get in more deadly accidents.
So we meet Scott at a place that isn't even on the map. It's called the Sure Station on the Jayhawk Pipeline.
And it is surreal looking. Enormous gleaming white tanks, long shiny pipes going off in every direction. One of these pipes is going to carry our oil to the CHS refinery in McPherson.
If it passes the test.
The test. Scott tells us before he can put Planet Money's oil in the pipeline, he has to do a quality check because it's going to mix with all the other, you know, professional oil.
Okay, now we're going to get this sample right here.
Scott pours a little sample of Planet Money oil into a test tube, and then he opens up this metal box that's attached to the side of his truck. And inside of it is something that looks like a rice cooker. Scott is traveling with his own centrifuge.
And then I put it in here and spin it out for 5 minutes.
And what are you looking for?
BS. BS is bottom settlement.
And what is that? That's dirt and gook?
Well, it's just stuff in the oil, yeah. But it lets you know whether the oil's good enough to buy.
So you've got a really good BS sensor.
There you go.
Scott reaches into the box and flips a switch.
If our oil does not pass this test, then Planet Money is stuck in Kansas with 100 barrels of crappy crude.
Well, let's see what we got here.
I am so nervous.
Me too.
See, we're talking about probably 7 tenths right there.
So is that good or bad? Or
that's viable.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, so he's not blown away by our oil. It's not A-plus oil. But hey, it's good enough to get us in the pipeline.
Once it mixes with the good stuff, no one will notice.
Okay, Robert.
Should we say anything before the oil goes into the pipeline?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the last time we're going to see it.
Goodbye, Planet Money Oil.
And now, Stacy, we wait. It is 45 miles from here to McPherson, Kansas. It's going to take all night for our oil to get there.
The pipeline moves very slowly, only about 3 miles an hour.
You could walk faster than the oil, but it does mean we have some time to kill now. So while we're waiting here on the radio, on the podcast, Stacy, you and Alex Goldmark are going to tell us a story, a legend, really, about the man who changed the oil business forever.
You've probably never heard his name, but you have definitely heard of the thing that he accidentally invented, fracking, as we know it today.
We'd like to say a quick thank you and share a message from our Planet Money sponsor, Discover. You check things all the time, like your email or social media. But Discover asks, what about checking something as important as your credit score? Well, Discover makes it quick and easy with the Discover Credit Scorecard. Discover is the only major credit card to offer FICO credit scores to everyone for free, even if you're not a customer. And once you know your FICO credit score, you should check to see if your current credit card is the best fit for you. Learn more at discover.com/creditscorecard. Limitations apply.
This whole process that Planet Money has been going through of buying oil, if there's one thing we learned on this journey, it is that there are a lot of steps. And no one knows that better than the man behind the plan, our senior producer, Alex Goldmark. Hey, Alex.
Hi, Stacey. More steps along the way than I can even possibly count, all of them worth it. But the whole process, all along the way, has been fundamentally changed by one man.
My full name is Nicholas Steinsberger. I'm 52 now, so 1995 would have been 31.
So the oil industry is legendary for these kind of aggressive, swashbuckling tycoon types, you know, at least in the movies. There's Daniel Day-Lewis from There Will Be Blood.
I drink your milkshake.
Drinking everybody's milkshake. There's Jared Ewing from Dallas. Nick Steinsberger is not one of those people. Nick is an engineer. He's a quiet guy with a big smile. He turns red really easily. His car is super tidy. It still has a new car smell.
What Nick did that changed the oil business forever is invented something called slick water fracking. That's basically just fracking as we know it today.
And he showed me the spot where it all happened, which is pretty much out in the middle of nowhere.
So we're between towns called of Justin and Ponder, Texas, which are two small little towns in north of Fort Worth area. I think Ponder National Bank was robbed by Bonnie and Clyde back in the 30s, I think, so.
Oh, claim to fame.
Claim to fame. Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting, I guess, where fracking was born?
Yeah, so where the modern slick water job was done successfully.
Yeah. By you?
By me, yes.
Fracking is a charged word. It has all of these really emotional associations. There are visions of environmental destruction, earthquakes in Oklahoma, stories of flammable tap water, and there's this whole other side of it. There's the big economic boom, whole cities rising up out of the prairie, out of nowhere, tens of thousands of high-paying jobs, and oil independence for the U.S.
And all of this drama started out in the most boring possible way. A quiet engineer trying to save his job on the least glamorous end of the oil business. It was 1995. Nick Steinsberger was working for a company called Mitchell Energy. He was 31. And he had just gotten a big promotion. He was put in charge of 200 oil and natural gas wells in Central Texas. It was an area called the Barnett Shale, named for the shale rock where the gas and oil deposits were stored.
Were you in a suit?
I think we had started to go to casual Fridays, but we were still wearing a coat and tie almost every day.
Nick walks into this big conference room with about 10 other men, and he's feeling pretty good. He is the youngest guy there by a lot. But then one of the executives starts talking about the area that Nick has just been put in charge of, the Barnett Shale. And the executive says, we got to get out of there.
The Barnett was failing. It was not an economic venture, and we probably were not going to be doing it much longer.
So a couple of months after you got promoted here, they were like, we think we're probably going to shut this down.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you feel at that meeting?
Well, a little depressed. I was thinking, well, maybe my job isn't so secure anymore.
You thought you were going to get fired.
Potentially, yes.
The wells Nick was in charge of were losing money. Getting natural gas out of the shale rock was way too expensive.
Shale rock is basically like a dried sponge, except it's made out of some of the hardest rock on Earth, and all of those little pockets are filled with oil and natural gas. To get the gas, Nick was drilling down a couple of miles into that shale rock and then blasting it apart with this white gel.
Consistency of a like snot or like jello, I'm sorry.
The gel shatters those little pockets in the sponge and lets this tiny amount of oil and gas flow out. It's like trying to get a French fry that's fallen in between the car seats. It's like you could get it, but it's a lot of effort, small reward.
That's very colorful. Although I have to say, if this were Nick Steinsberger's car, there would be no French fries.
No, just the tidiest car in Texas. But look, nobody wanted to put in that kind of effort on the Barnett Shale. In fact, Exxon's headquarters were just down the road from Nick's Wells, right on the Barnett Shale, and they weren't doing anything about it. Gregory Zuckerman is the author of The Frackers.
You could see that the headquarters of Exxon, the biggest oil and gas producer in this country, is literally, not even figuratively, literally on top of the Barnett Shale. And yet ExxonMobil was drilling anywhere but their literal backyard. They were offshore. They were in Africa. They were in Asia. And that was because the conventional wisdom at the time was don't waste your time trying to get gas from shale, even in your backyard.
So they knew that the shale was there.
Yeah, everyone knew. It was no mystery. They just didn't think it was worth their time.
But it was worth Nick Steinsberger's time. He and his wife had a new baby, and this was a rough time for the oil industry. Layoffs were happening all over the place, and Nick thought, if I lose this job, I might not be able to get another one. So he leaves the manager's meeting in Houston, he goes back to Fort Worth, and he decides that he is going to find a way to save his job.
You know, over the next days or, you know, at night, you know, thinking, well, what can I do? As an engineer thinks, well, you can become more efficient and cost savings.
Just little trims here and there.
Yeah, that's right.
Nick knew right where to trim. That gel. It was expensive. It was made up of a ton of chemicals. Half the cost of fracking came from that gel. So Nick's idea, just like a bar might start watering down the cocktails to stretch the liquor further, Nick started watering down that gel. He put in a little more water and a little less chemical mix.
So I was keep on reducing those amount of gel or amount of chemicals we were pumping by, yeah, just making small tweaks every week or two.
As Nick added more water to the gel, he noticed something weird. The wells with the watered-down gel were producing just as much natural gas as the wells with the full-strength gel. So Nick kept pushing the envelope, adding a little more water and a little more water and a little more water.
To do the actual drilling, Nick contracts out to these big companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger, and they are not fans of this watering down plan because they sell the gel. And every time Nick waters it down, these companies sell less of it. And so to make up for the money that they're losing from this watered down gel, Nick says the company started charging him all kinds of new fees. One charged a horsepower fee for the trucks and equipment they were putting on site. Another company charged a non-gelling fee, charging more for using less of their product.
And then one day on one of the drill sites, these guys say, now you've done it. You've hit the ceiling. You've put too much water in. And now the gel is not gelling.
And it got to be so I was had reduced them by so much that they were telling me the product they were pumping downhole was just a thick, watery substance.
Oh, it's like if you make jello with too much water, it just doesn't gel. It's just sugar water.
Right. So I didn't pump the jello. I pumped the non-gel jello.
Why did you decide to pump it anyway?
I'm not sure. I was mad at him. But you know, we were already on that. We were already so close to there already that I said, let's just pump it and see what happens, basically.
This was definitely kind of a swaggery oil man, I drink your milkshake moment for Nick. Botching a drill job is no joke. Drilling a well costs almost $1 million. And nobody, not even Nick, thought the well would work without at least a little gel to crack the rock apart.
Here's the worry. Conventional wisdom was that pumping too much water into the Barnett Shale would make the clay down there swell up and become a big slimy mess, blocking all of those pockets of oil and gas, and then nothing would come out at all.
So Nick stood there, super mad and starting to get super worried. He watched the drill team pump the super watered down, non-gelled gel into the ground. And it was like this standoff. The gel mixing guys are standing there getting ready for their big I told you so moment. Nick is standing there braced for the big I told you so moment.
But it never came. Even with the overwatered jello, that well produced the same amount of gas as the gel wells had.
In fact, it produced a little bit more. Nick had no idea why this was happening. But standing there, he had this eureka moment. What if we just used water? That would cut costs by a third. We could add just a little bleach to kill the bacteria, a little soap to make the water flow more easily down the pipes. And if we did that, The Barnett Shale wells would be profitable, no question. And he could keep his job.
So he picked a well to test his theory on.
All right. Can we go see it?
Yeah.
So about 20 years ago, today, you were driving up, as we are right now, to this well to see if your idea had worked.
That's right.
The well itself looks so underwhelming. I know that it goes a couple of miles underground, but all I can see is just this little tangle of pipes sitting on a 20 by 10 gravel plot surrounded by a chain link fence with a metal sign wired to it. So do you mind reading the sign?
Okay, the name of the sign says the S.H. Griffin number 4. There's still the Mitchell Energy sign on it.
So that's the original sign that was there.
That was the original sign that was there.
The S.H. Griffin number 4, named after the family that sold the land. It was June, but kind of chilly and overcast. And Nick got up before dawn, put on jeans and a hard hat and work boots, got some coffee, and arrived at the well.
This whole area that we're sitting on, this 3 acres, it would have been full of people and equipment and sand and water to do this job at that point.
Do you remember that day?
Oh, yeah.
What was it like?
There would have been about 10 frac pumps.
How big are those?
They're a big truck.
Giant drills, thousands of feet long, went down into S.H. Griffin number 4 and into the shale. 800,000 gallons of Nick's soapy water, what he was calling slick water, were blasted into the rock.
And what did you see?
We saw the pressure was going up and up and up and up, and we were excited.
So the pressure valve was like the modern version of a gusher.
I guess so, yeah.
Nick is a reserved guy, but he told me this was one of the biggest moments of his life.
The gas started to flow and flow and flow.
Tightly enclosed in tubes, of course.
Without any gel. The water had smashed the shale and created a gusher. Nick's well produced double what other wells were producing.
Hydraulic fracturing, fracking as we know it, was in business.
Right here.
The world changed.
I didn't know they realized that at the time, but yes.
No one could have realized at the time what a game changer this was. Fracking with water was way cheaper, but it also produced way more natural gas. And they tried the same technique on oil. Same results. 20 years later, the U.S. is the largest producer of oil and natural gas in the world because of fracking.
Nick's boss at Mitchell Energy became a billionaire. Nick did not. In fact, he didn't even get a bonus.
It seems unfair that it's your invention.
They were better businessmen than I was. I was a young engineer, and I had no idea about the business world, about I was in a very small microcosm of that industry. I'm also quiet, I'm pretty quiet and reserved. So, you know, other people are, the oil industry has a lot of interesting characters in it, and a lot of people are very outgoing, very aggressive.
In the meantime, Nick was watching the world change because of his invention. When Nick had started out his career in the early 90s, everyone was talking about how the world was running out of oil, how the price was going to go up and up and up, and all of the problems that was going to cause.
Nick's invention meant that there were enormous reserves of oil and gas right here beneath our feet that could be cheaply extracted. Gregory Zuckerman, the author of The Frackers, says it's almost impossible to overestimate how much fracking has changed the U.S.
It was a consensus that we were running out of oil and gas in this country, and we were going to be dependent on nations that we really didn't want to depend on for the future. And to think that in a short number of years, we not only have this surplus and glut, we're actually exporting oil and gas from this country. It's remarkable. It opens up all kinds of opportunities for us.
Gregory says the whole global power structure changed. You're Saudi Arabia, you're suddenly bringing in half as much money as you were. You're Venezuela, Russia, your whole economy is falling apart because oil prices are lower and the U.S. is not buying oil like it used to. If you're in the U.S., you've got lots of jobs. Gas is cheaper.
And if you're an environmentalist, this is really bad news. Just starting with the issues of drilling itself. Fracking has been linked to earthquakes in Oklahoma, flammable tap water in Kentucky. Nick says he's heard all of these things.
People really hate fracking.
Yeah, I think that's very disturbing to me. I am an environmentalist. I'm a Boy Scout. I love camping, hiking. I love the environment. And I'm not, and I've been on thousands of frack jobs. You know, fracking is misunderstood. You know, fracking with a K, that bothers me because fracture stimulation does not have a K in that word, but they put a K in it because it's quantified, you know, it's a dirty word that way.
Nick says the problems with frack sites are overblown and that fracking has really improved over the last 10 years.
But individual drill sites are not the real environmental problem. The real problem is what fracking has done to the price of oil. If you're an environmentalist, you want oil to be expensive, to push us into alternative fuels. When gas is cheap, people drive more, people buy more SUVs, there's no economic incentive to change.
Fracking took us from a world where we thought it was just going to be more and more expensive to get that last little bit of oil out of the ground. But now it has opened up so many new oil fields that the alternatives, solar and wind, they just don't make as much economic sense anymore.
Nick says he doesn't look at it that way.
Of all the potential issues or issues with it, I think it creates so many benefits for our country, both economically, the amount of jobs, the amount of economic revenue we've established here, and the security for our own country.
Nick says he's proud to have invented fracking. He's even made peace with the fact that he did not get rich off of his invention. He's got his own consulting firm now and a big family, 5 kids.
Nick did tell me that if he could go back in time, he would have been a little more aggressive. He would have quit Mitchell Energy, started his own company, and grabbed some of the glory and money for himself. But as we were about to leave the oil field, Nick did something that totally surprised me. He told me he really wanted to steal the sign, the metal sign that was wired to the chain link fence, the one that marks his first hydraulically fracked well, S.H. Griffin number 4.
I'm definitely taking this up. I don't have any flyers.
Nick tells me he wants to put the sign in his living room. He tells me it's important to his soul. And suddenly, it's important to my soul that Nick puts the sign in his living room.
I got the top one, but I think that's just the easy one, yeah.
In the end, we could not get the sign off the fence. We had to leave it there.
It's all right. I'll come back someday and get it.
That sign should be yours.
So, Stacey, the Planet Money oil that you and Robert bought in a field in Kansas, that was not from a fracked well. But like every other well in this country and all the oil in America now, it was affected by Nick Steinsberger's innovation.
Because when fracking went big time, the amount of available oil in the U.S. more than doubled. Selling oil got a lot more competitive, and the price went down.
That was good for us when we were buying our oil, but we also have to sell our oil. It'll eventually make its way to a refinery, and over the next couple episodes, it'll get turned into fuel and other products that people can buy. But the refinery will not buy directly from us. So, Stacey, you and Robert Smith called up somebody else.
My name is Joshua Wade. I'm with Ascent Midstream Partners. I'm a crude oil purchaser.
So, are you a middleman we always hear about, the middleman?
Yeah, I technically do take ownership of it, but it's only for a fraction of a second. Milliseconds.
Can you make a profit by owning oil for milliseconds?
You can.
Josh agreed to buy our 100 barrels of oil, and we were hoping to make a little profit off of it, or at least break even.
So,
we should probably talk price.
So the price that we were looking to do for this barrel is $31.20 a barrel.
Okay.
That
feels low.
We paid Jason Bruns, the guy who drilled our oil, we paid him $40 a barrel.
Okay.
We were starting to get the feeling that this was not going to go well. Josh told us he could not give us $40 a barrel or even anything close to that. And part of the problem was timing. Because in this market, oil is bought and sold using a monthly average. And when we bought our oil, it was July 29th. And we were using the price for July when we bought our oil from Jason Bruns. But you might remember that a huge storm blew into Kansas and the roads got so muddy that the oil truck could not get in. We could not sell our oil. And by the time the roads dried out, it was August. And the price for oil was much lower. So when we were trying to sell our oil to Josh, we were looking at a much different price.
So I'm going to boil this down. It looks like we lost $820 on the deal.
It sounds like it a little bit.
So you're telling me Jason Bruns, oil man, and preacher.
And preacher.
Pastor on the weekends, made out like a bandit off of this oil deal.
I wouldn't say he made out like a bandit. He got a good deal.
We also bought him lunch.
Now, depending on how much that lunch was, he got a really good deal.
A really good deal for August prices, anyway, according to Josh.
Are you saying if it had not rained and we could have gotten that oil out in July instead of August?
Yeah.
Then we would have made up better on this deal?
Yeah. And that's what happens a lot of times in this industry.
Robert, I think we have no business in the oil business, is what I think.
I think we're a little bit cursed.
I think, well, also that. So, okay, we lost $800 on our oil deal, but our oil is in the system. Next time on Planet Money, we follow our oil to the refinery and see what becomes of our 100 barrels.
If you've got questions about our oil or want to tell us how we could have done a better deal negotiating for it, send us an email. We are planetmoney@npr.org.
Also, we've been posting photos from our oil journey. You can check them out on Twitter and Facebook. Go find us there. Today's episode was produced by Nick Fountain. Thanks, Nick.
And we want to thank Christian Curtin, our comptroller at NPR, who even knew we had a comptroller. He had to deal with all of our regulatory filings incorporating us in the state of Kansas to buy oil legally. Thank you, Christian.
And if you are looking for another podcast, check out NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Every week they talk about the latest movies and books and TV shows, and they have really interesting discussions with people like Trevor Noah and Shonda Rhimes. You can check that out on the NPR One app or at npr.org/podcasts. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith.
And I'm Alex Goldmark. Thanks for listening.